In recent years, Taiwan's cultural policies have aimed to expand the definition of Taiwanese to be more multicultural. In addition to supporting the inclusion of minorities, broadening the definition of Taiwanese helps establish Taiwan as a nation with a unique culture that differs from the PRC. Today we will talk with Dr. Aoi about Taiwan's indigenous communities, how they have been treated domestically, and how they factor into Taiwan's image internationally. So, let's get into it. Hello everyone, and welcome to Taiwan Salon, the Global Taiwan Institute's Cultural Policy and Soft Power Podcast. My name is Adrienne Wu, the host of Taiwan Salon and a research assistant at GTI.
And I'm Zoe Weaver-Lee, a program assistant at GTI.
Today we are joined by Aoi Mona, Associate Professor of Law and Indigenous Studies at National Donghua University.
A member of the Saitic Nation himself, Dr. Aoi's research focuses primarily on indigenous law, indigenous title law, and cultural and education law. He has served on numerous committees related to indigenous rights and is currently the Legal Aid Foundation's Director of the Legal Center of Indigenous Peoples.
All right. So I'd like to begin somewhat broadly to set the stage for Taiwan's current efforts related to soft power. According to Joseph S. Nye, soft power comes from three sources: culture, political values, and foreign policy. In your opinion, what are the key sources of Taiwan's soft power?
I think Taiwan has a very special position, globally speaking. Since the Taiwan's withdrawal from the United Nations, I think everything we do to connect to the international community, mainly through the so-called soft power. And after the lifted of martial law, Taiwan has changed into a democratic country, and also the society becomes more we embrace the multiculturalism is as our main values for Taiwan, and especially after the first changing of power in Taiwan in 2000, and the indigenous policy has become, I would say, indigenous issues or policy has become one of the main appearance of Taiwan to the international community. So, having said that, I think the key sources of Taiwan's soft power come from the three things you just mentioned at the same time. And I would say maybe since the lifted of martial law until the year 2000 or the first changing of political power, because Taiwan has become a democratic country. So the political values has been a main sources between that time. But after the year 2000, I would say the culture and especially the indigenous culture has becoming a driving forces for the Taiwan soft power to connect to the international communities.
That's a really great, refreshing answer. And one of the pieces you talked about being mainly indigenous policy, we'd like to dive into that more for this episode because this is your area of expertise. So could you talk a little bit about the presence of indigenous people and indigenous movements in Taiwan's history and maybe highlight some of the crucial moments that are important for people to know about?
I might start with the relationship between the indigenous people with the state in Taiwan. I think we have to put the relationship in the context of the political structure of Taiwan. As you may know, Taiwan has been under the authoritarian rules for almost half century. So after we lifted the martial law and we transferred our political structure from authoritarian rule become the democratic, along with Taiwan's democratic movement, at the same time, the indigenous movement has been one of the key issues back to 1980s through 1990s. But before the indigenous movement, the government, no matter we call it the Republic of China or Taiwan, they kind of take the position as the European countries when they arrive at the continent of America, to see them as some kind of barbarians. And in the name of God, the European has the manifest destiny to assimilate, to integrate the indigenous people in the America of continent. And I think that kind of situation had taken place in Taiwan since the occupation of Japanese government until after the post-World War II, before we end the Austrian rules. So I think that that's the context we must put in mind. So I would say the situation or the indigenous movement in Taiwan, I would divide it into three different phases. So the first phase is from the 1980s through 1990s. So like I said earlier, that is along with the democratic movement in Taiwan. So the first phase of indigenous movement, because of the more comprehensive democratic movement in Taiwan, so we have revised the Constitution of Republic of China, Taiwan, to change the name of the indigenous people from Sanbao, the Sanbao called the Mountain Peoples. So this term has been used by the government as to depict the indigenous people is like the in the earlier stage of human society, or in more simple term, is the same idea as the barbarian. So we changed the term used in the constitution to replace Sanbao with indigenous peoples. And in the fourth revision of the constitution, we even to include the indigenous article to safeguard or to recognize indigenous people's policy and rights has been protected under the constitution. I would compare it with the Canadian 1982 constitution, Article 35. I would say it has a similar significance. So that, I would say, that's the first phase of indigenous movement. And the second phase of indigenous movement was taken place after the first changing of political power in 2000. Why I would say that was the second phase? Because back that time, the ruling party of the government has set the indigenous policy, the foundation as the Taiwan government should construct a new partnership relationship with indigenous peoples. So the so-called new partnership between the indigenous peoples and the government was taken from around 1990s, the United Nations policy to advance indigenous human rights. So in 2000, the government has set the foundation with the indigenous peoples on the ground of new partnership. And in 2004, the ruling party at that time, they even further the indigenous policy with the indigenous people to declare the Republic of China, Taiwan government should sit on the equal footing as the nation-to-nation basis to negotiate, to develop the indigenous policy and related laws to implement, for the implementation. With these two political documents, I would say it's more like a political document. So the first one is new partnership, and the second one is the nation-to-nation political announcement. So with these two political documents in place, we finally enact the most important legislation in Taiwan for indigenous peoples in 2005, that is Indigenous Peoples Basic Law. So with this enactment of Indigenous Peoples Basic Law, we launched a series of indigenous legislation development and policy development. So I would say that is the second phase of indigenous movement. And the reason I say we have the three phases of indigenous movement is that on the August 1st, 2016, President Tsai Ing-wen, she delivered a national apology on behalf of the government to say sorry for the indigenous peoples. So this national apology has leveled up the indigenous rights claim to the idea of indigenous historical justice and transitional justice. That means we can retrace or we can reinvigorate the historical rights claim based on the third phases of indigenous movement. So I think that's kind of a broad picture for the question you just mentioned.
Despite the introduction of indigenous policies into Taiwanese law, the question remains, are these policies truly improving indigenous people's way of living?
It's not easy to evaluate how does this legislation or the policy has implemented on the grassroots level. But compared to the authoritarian rules or even the indigenous people has been gone through the assimilation policy, I would say the negotiation power or the position with the government has become more and more powerful. But still, the resources and the administrative power still controlled by the government. So definitely still have the huge deficiencies if you want to compare to the indigenous expectations. But one thing I would say for the past, since the 2016, after the president delivered the national apology to indigenous peoples, one thing will be the main driving forces, I would say, to advance the indigenous rights claims. That is about the reinvigoration of indigenous language, cultures, and education. So, and maybe we can talk about this in details later. But apart from language, cultures, and education, the main challenges for the indigenous peoples, even we have the indigenous people's special law in place, is about land and resources management. And the issue of indigenous land and natural resources control and management. So even we have a legislation saying that the government recognizes indigenous rights to land and natural resources, but still we have seen a lot of land construction and natural resources exploitation taken place in on indigenous land area. So for the past, for the past decade or more, even more, we have confront against the government, even the private like entities, to sue them on the justifications or on the disposition of indigenous land rights. So what I'm trying to say is the law would not give the indigenous people the right in a good way. So the law needs to be conducted by the government. Otherwise, it won't have the actual effect. So for the past decades, because of the government attitude and also private entities, they're still trying to manipulate the indigenous legislations. So we have used another channel to against the government and the private entities through the judicial power. So for the past decade, we have seen a series of court decisions to support indigenous rights claim to manage indigenous land and natural resources. So it has been a huge success for indigenous peoples, but it takes time and money to pursue through the judicial power. So this is still one of the challenges for the indigenous peoples.
Yeah, indigenous communities have also been the main focus of Taiwanese tourism, with attractions such as the Taiwanese Indigenous People's Culture Park in Pingdong and the Formosan Aboriginal Cultural Village in Nantou. So has tourism been a good opportunity for Indigenous communities to teach visitors about their culture? Or in your opinion, does it commodify Indigenous culture?
Yeah, I think that is a very critical question or point for the Indigenous people's interaction with the non-Indigenous public. And also, if we put the situation for the past 2 years and the effect of COVID-19, I think the Taiwan's policy has been more strict compared to other countries, because we still haven't opened for the foreigners to come to Taiwan. So what I'm trying to say is, because the public for the past 2 years all stay at Taiwan, so the tourism has been a very important issue. And of course, the indigenous tourism has been one of the main exposure for the Taiwan for the foreign friends, not only for the local peoples. Let me take one example. I'm not sure whether you are familiar with one of the small island situated on the southeastern side of Taiwan that we call Orchid Island. In Mandarin, we call it Lanyu. So that's the land for the Yami people or the Dao peoples, the one of the main indigenous peoples in Taiwan. And on that island, they have a population around maybe 3,000 to 5,000. But every year, more than 100,000 people will go to that island for tourism. So there has been a lot of different conflict and issues, not only on the example I just mentioned, the Orchid Island, and also on the other parts of indigenous communities. Because even though indigenous movement in Taiwan has been gone through three different phases, and even though we have a series of indigenous legislation to advance indigenous rights and even through the education system, but still the Taiwan's general public still have some kind of stereotype on the indigenous individuals and indigenous communities. Let me take one example, like when people visit indigenous communities, some of the common reflection from those non-indigenous public, they will ask about why you people don't dress your traditional outfit, that kind of questions. And also they might have questioned about why you serve general meals like the peoples in Taiwan instead of serve your traditional foods. So those kind of images are common to non-indigenous public. So I think indigenous tourism has been one of the main attractions, not only for local peoples, but also for the foreign visitors. But still, the stereotype still attached to those visitors on indigenous peoples. I think that is the one that will be some of the issues about the tourism on indigenous communities.
Highlighting Taiwan's multiculturalism has offered a way for the Taiwanese government to differentiate Taiwan from the PRC. How did this interest come about, and has this been good for Taiwan's indigenous communities?
So in a simple way, in Taiwan, especially after year 2000, from a number of different academic research has disclosed that indigenous peoples in Taiwan might be the sources of the so-called Austronesian dispersed across the Pacific Ocean. So since the academia brought about this kind of research findings, the Taiwan government has been used this kind of images to declare or to set the stage for the Taiwan's independence, culturally speaking, or even to advance into the political area to differentiate from PRC and Taiwan. I think that is the idea the people of Taiwan we all know about. But in a practical area, especially as the indigenous individual like myself, I have noticed that for the past decades or so, the foreign visitors, I mean high political officials from the Pacific Oceans area, regularly to visit Taiwan to emphasize our relationship from the indigenous peoples to those countries across Pacific Oceans. So that is one of the appearance of the our indigenous connection to the Pacific Ocean. And also, I used to participate to attend the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in New York, and also some of the UN conference or the meetings in Geneva or other parts of Europe. Even though that is the international meetings, but for the delegations from Taiwan, mostly we always will perform or to expose ourselves from the to use the indigenous culture or indigenous connections. So that is also one of the practices we see. And another thing is the government of Taiwan has a series of policies to promote Taiwan's research. And the government of Taiwan, they even to donate or to make some kind of grant for the foreign countries' universities or higher education institutions to set up like Taiwan Chair or the Taiwan Studies. I think the Taiwan Study has become more and more popular in some of the key countries like Canada, like the UK, or even some of the European countries. And apart from the education approach, in the past years, I also noticed from the Ministry of Culture of Taiwan, they have set up Taiwan Spotlight Taiwan program. And also under these different programs, the indigenous issues has been one of the key items to promote the Taiwan appearance. So those are the things I think I will share to you.
Well, thank you for listing such specific examples. I think that's really helpful for our audience to get to know some of the existing programs that Taiwan is putting forth to get more discussion going about indigenous issues in Taiwan. But you bring us to a nice close here, actually, Dr. Awi, because we would like it if you could possibly comment on, you know, the future of Taiwan's soft power. So you've highlighted what's going on now, but are there some challenges that you expect Taiwan to face, or maybe some opportunities that Taiwan should take advantage of?
I think if we take the approach of soft power, for me as an indigenous individuals, indigenous cultures or indigenous approach will be one of the key advancements to further up the Taiwan's participation into the international communities. If you want me to comment on some challenges for Taiwan to face, I think the cross-strait relationship with the PRC has always been the issues. If we put the political issues aside, one thing I would say is that the relationship inside Taiwan we use to identify Taiwan's society is composed of four different groups, as we say Minnan, Hakka, Waisheng, and indigenous peoples. But right now, Taiwan has the fifth participant as the new immigrant or newcomers from outside of Taiwan. So that kind of intensify the mainstream or the main group of Minnan peoples. So the challenges will be how inclusion, the idea of multiculturalism will be in Taiwan. I think that will be a main challenges for the indigenous soft power if we want to further advancement on that. So I'm not sure whether it will be appropriate to compare to the situation of Canada, because Canada, in my opinion, has been one of the main countries for the advancement of multiculturalism. But it also has some, like we might say, is a negative influences. So I think that will be some of the issues the Taiwan must to face. And to conclude, I think the future of Taiwan's soft power has to continue build upon the three sources: the culture, the political values, and foreign policy. Culture has been a very energetic, no matter it is indigenous culture or other appearance of from other group of cultures. And political values in Taiwan, I would say we have shown to the international communities Taiwan's political value on democratic democracy are solid. But since the relationship or the more intensified relationship with the PRC, I think the political values or the political agenda will be influenced by the foreign policy. And that is another challenge to the Taiwan soft power, I would say. So that will conclude my comments.
Thank you so much for joining us once again. It's really great to hear from an Indigenous scholar and to get more of a rounded picture of Taiwan's different communities.
Thank you.
The progress that the government has made in protecting Indigenous rights is heartening, even though it's clear that much work still needs to be done. Thank you so much to Dr. Awi for joining us, and to you, our listeners, for tuning in. This podcast was made possible in part by the Taiwan Academy Spotlight Taiwan Grant. Production assistance is from Adrian Wu and Zoe Weaver-Lee. Thank you also to our staff and interns for your support in making this episode possible. Intro and background music is by I'm Difficult Wolsher Jicho Xiaomu. The Global Taiwan Institute is a 501c3 think tank located in Washington, D.C. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief and our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of Taiwan Salon on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcasts, as well as on our website's podcast page. Thank you for listening, and until next time.